So these are some thoughts, some quick comments on Milton Friedman and this famous text, Capitalism and Freedom. We have a very specific set of, I won't even call them arguments here, positions, which are expressed by Friedman. I'm not going to spend a ton of time on them because I feel like they're extremely familiar. We've all heard this sort of stuff. And in a strange way, because we've already talked about Adam Smith, I feel like we've just kind of got the updated version of Adam Smith. We have a post-New Deal version of Adam Smith. Instead of the free market, we're going to talk about competitive capitalism, but we're still going to talk about the free market, and the positions are going to be almost identical. The emphasis a little bit changed, but the basic idea is still that idea of the invisible hand, that if you let business and the so-called free market unfold as it naturally would, that is, without regulation and without labor unions and without a whole lot of other stuff that corporations don't like, supposedly everybody's going to be happy, that this competitive capitalist system is probably the only one worth discussing, the only economic system which is conducive to so-called political freedom. And the idea of freedom, which Friedman gets from the liberal tradition, he calls himself a liberal. We tend to call him a neoliberal, you know, a new generation of these liberal thinkers who are really also capitalist and business thinkers. Competitive capitalism is the economic system which produces these freedoms, individual and political. If we think about Friedman as ideology, and I have trouble seeing it as anything but, honestly, if you look at the quotation I put at the top of the notes here, you'll see I started with this passage from the Communist Manifesto in which Marx says, basically, you know, what happens under capitalism is that everything gets reduced to a relationship of monetary exchange. Things that used to be outside the sphere of economics and profit-making, relationships between parents and children, relationships between neighbors, under the capitalist regime, get reduced to capitalist exchange. These capitalists who dominate the world and who control the distribution of ideas to this world cannot help but put everything in their own language. That is the language of their own practice, which here Friedman will call the game or competitive capitalism. I can't help it. Like, that's what I see. Now, I'll try to lay out Friedman's position. And I almost want to say his arguments, but I have trouble seeing arguments here. I rather see a list of positions, and I see a very transparent relationship between these positions and real people in the real world who Friedman is serving as their ideologist, if you ask me. Now, Friedman's positioning with respect to the real world order and his association with one or another social class, with a particular social class, is really obvious. You know, whereas with, say, Adam Smith, yeah, he had affiliations with, you know, the upper class and capitalists, but he was a middle class academic primarily. And so we could wonder about how does he end up expressing this view, which seems so much to be the view of this new capitalist class. With Friedman, no such questions are necessary. Friedman is an economist. He's a recipient of the Nobel Prize in economics. If you check out the Naomi Klein link that I gave you, which really situates Milton Friedman in his historical and political reality, she'll point out that the economics prize is different from all the other ones in that it is controlled by economic powers. So maybe we ought not to esteem him as much as otherwise. Besides, some of the greatest killers in the world, you know, Henry Kissinger got the Nobel Peace Prize, so maybe we shouldn't have any respect for the Nobel Prize at all. Anyway, Friedman develops and is central to the Chicago School of Economics, and that is an important place historically because through his program, through working with him, the financial leadership, which goes along with the dictatorships, a number of dictatorships across South America, particularly Pinochet in Chile, and then the policies that were then implemented in Iraq and which were also implemented in Argentina, other places in South America in the 1970s, it's not just that Milton Friedman expresses the principles which are pursued in those economic experiments in those places. He also trained the experts who went and administered those policies. So there's a direct connection between Friedman, large-scale northern and especially American multinational companies, and then the actual political class, the advisory political class that went and worked with Pinochet after the CIA engineered and backed a violent coup to push out Salvador Allende, who was nationalizing resources to be used by the population for the population. Pinochet takes over in a military junta. Allende is killed. And these students of Milton Friedman's go to Chile in order to implement this free market strategy. And the claim here in this text is that competitive capitalism and individual freedom and political freedom totally go together. But the thing that is so striking to me is that they are so clearly opposed to one another in the case of Chile or in the case of Iraq later on. In the first case, we have a clear military dictatorship with a profoundly violent secret police force backed by the CIA, which tortures and disappears people, does away with all political liberties and individual liberties. And then in Iraq, we have the situation of total military occupation and destruction of the cultural and social fabric and production of civil war. These do not seem to be the results that Friedman predicts. If we do competitive capitalism, we're also going to have the best chances for political and individual freedom. So I have trouble hearing this guy without having a visceral reaction. But, okay, what is it that he's saying? He is saying that this particular economic system is conducive to these freedoms. He's speaking from a particular position, which is a strong alliance with banks and capitalists, and then with a military apparatus, which is working together with those entities globally. And he's speaking clearly opposed to other interests. So he and Hayek, who we'll move on to next, are radical opponents of socialists and all sorts of socialists, right? He sort of denies he directly denies, although he does not give extensive reasoning as to why there cannot be any such thing as social democracy. That is a socialization of the economic dimension with the maintenance of political liberty at the decision-making level. He says this is impossible, but he says it is impossible primarily by comparing this social democratic idea to the state socialisms that everybody loves to hate in 1962, particularly the Soviet Union and maybe by implication also China. So he's speaking in opposition to socialists. And in this, of course, recognize that he's also speaking in exactly the language of the Cold War. He's saying the same thing that the American government says. And he says things that we are all programmed to say. When most Americans think about socialism, they have been trained up to think about totalitarianism. And there's a reason for that. The Soviet Union really was totalitarian. This is who he's speaking against. But of course, there's also a socialist perspective in the United States, which I think corresponds with the working class. And he's speaking against that perspective. More concretely, in 1962, he is speaking against the New Deal. He's speaking against this radical change that happened as the result of the Great Depression and the near insurrection on the part of the working and unworking poor in the 1930s, and then the kind of reconstruction that happened through World War II, out of which we get things like welfare, Social Security, minimum wage. These are the kinds, and regulations on industry. These are the kinds of things that he is directly arguing against. And in whose interest does he therefore speak? He speaks in the interest of the big companies who don't want to spend money to support the lower class, who want their taxes reduced to nothing, who don't want to have to pay into unemployment or Social Security, and who don't want to have any of their businesses regulated in any way, and furthermore, don't want to have anything to do with unions. Unions are enfranchised through the process of the New Deal. These are the opponents. Supposedly in this picture, competitive capitalism and political freedom, the economic sphere and the political sphere act as checks upon one another. They are supposedly separate. Like I said, I have trouble seeing how this is actually the case, because in the 1900s, you have the Carnegies putting politicians in their pockets, and in the 2000s, we have big business and corporations writing its own legislation. I don't see how we're supposed to believe this, actually, but this is the claim. And it's easily compared to what he's doing is saying, like, look, in the totalitarian and the Soviet Union, the economic and the political decisions are made from one position, and therefore the state is out of control and there is nothing to check the state. Whereas in the competitive capitalist system, the economic sphere is free and uncentered, another blatant falsification, because it seems like every industry in so-called competitive capitalism tends towards monopoly, and therefore capitalism is not actually ultimately competitive. But the claim is that the economic sphere is decentered and flexible and adaptive, and it can deal with most of the practical things that everyday people need to have dealt with. The political sphere should be extremely limited, and it's undesirable in a number of ways. It's undesirable because it in itself constitutes a possibility of unfreedom. So if a government makes rules, these bear upon the action of individuals. But of course, individuals and households and corporations are really undistinguished in Friedman. In fact, I think he says that he's talking about individuals and households, but he's really talking about businesses. Right, because the household is defined as the unit of social order, and yet it is also defined as a fundamental productive and consumptive unit. What does the household do? It produces goods and services, and it exchanges them. I mean, not all households would recognize themselves in that definition, and yet that's how he thinks about things, right? So the claim is that the economic sphere can take care of most things in life, and you can avoid politics. Most of the decisions that need to be made can be made by buying one way or the other. You can vote by how you buy about what is a better brand and which company is going to survive. Supposedly, freedom of choice, as well as freedom of economic activity, that is the freedom to make money, are both achievable almost entirely in the economic sphere. The political sphere is on the one hand a threat because it wants to regulate. It can only operate, go back to Adam Smith, right? Like, it can only operate negatively upon this allegedly free economic behavior. But also then, and I think the things that Friedman says here, although they irritate me so much, I certainly hear them from all kinds of people in the world, both, you know, with high school educations or less, and people with PhDs. They all say these sorts of things. That we should avoid politics as much as possible. That politics is like a necessary evil. We don't like, it's not like our nature is related to that, or like, you know, like something profoundly human is going on when we get together in a group and make decisions. He doesn't think that way at all. Politics is divisive. Politics produces conflict. I think there's something very American about this idea. We don't want to talk about political things or religious things or whatever, because they're just going to lead to more conflict, and we're afraid of this conflict. We're afraid of the political. Friedman is giving us kind of superficial reasons to be afraid of the political, or he's repeating the thing that we are all supposed to feel about the political. Now, this corresponds to attitudes that I think really are central to liberalism, and that Friedman considers central to liberalism, the emphasis on the individual, and the idea that freedom is a fundamentally private affair. You have freedom in your own house. You have freedom with respect to what music are you going to listen to, or what, you know, what restaurant are you going to call if you're going to order a pizza. Freedom about, like, you know, what kind of like practices are you going to engage in that like give you pleasure. It's nobody else's business what you do in your own home, right? There's a very private notion of freedom. And there's also a very dangerous, although very American, very liberal idea here as well, which is, I mean, I've been doing classes about thinking through indigenous views of the world, and this is one of the things that contemporary indigenous thinkers fundamentally criticize in the Western worldview, and that is the idea that ethics also is a fundamentally private affair. It doesn't have anything to do with economy on the large scale, and it's not really what's happening in politics, which is just a negotiation of different interests with respect to things that are outside the reach of economy in the best case. Ethics, what is right and wrong, what should be done, this is a private thing too. So we get this like this liberal view about toleration, where okay, you think that you know we ought to save the environment, but I think that like you know I really like dig you know big houses made out of endangered wood, and I really like to eat steak, and so they ought to keep cutting down the rainforest because I don't care. And the liberal view is like you know we're both equals, we're both equally free, and we are free to think the things that we think within the privacy of our own homes, but neither of our views should really bear upon the overall game. The game. And the game is never questioned in Friedman, right? It just is. It is this good thing that good people engage in. Now, like, what's a pseudo-argument here off to the side? The claim is that competitive capitalism is clearly an economic system which is associated with freedom and prosperity, which somehow go together in this view, because look at the 1800s and the 1900s in Europe and the United States. There has never been a time on the face of the earth, says this ideological colonial voice. There has never been such prosperity. There has never been such freedom to consume, freedom to move about as you like, provided that you have the money. He never discusses that you might not have the money. Supposedly, there is this freedom and prosperity, which is unprecedented, which, of course... Oh, and then there's also another doctrine here, which is that the global north, these colonial centers, are advanced. They are the advanced portions of the world. They are advanced so-called democracies. They are advanced competitive capitalist systems. They are the forefront of technological advancement. They are the best way that anyone has ever lived. And the rest of the world is backwards because it's not keeping up with this game. Of course, there's no recognition whatsoever. There's an utter hiding of... slavery, of genocide, of the position of women and Mexicans, not to mention black people and indigenous people in these systems. There's no recognition that the wealth of Europe seems very much to be related to the utter trashing and rape of Africa and India and Indonesia. Colonialism is not looked at all. The idea that this advancedness, this advancement, this increase of technology and increase of like where one very specific model of comfortable living could be at the expense of people, that it could be anything except for just the outside of the system. And I think this is typical of economic thinking, especially within capitalism. It's rational internally. This is what Chomsky's going to tell us later in the semester. It's rational internally. If you accept all the rules of the game, then you can let your cognition operate in very sophisticated and complex ways, which is what Friedman does and why he gets that Nobel Prize. But if you look outside the system, all of a sudden the system starts to look extremely violent. But lucky for Milton, he never does that. He never has to do that. Okay, and then there's this position about the role of government, which is extremely predictable. And it's like what we saw in Locke and in Smith. These guys really do share this so-called liberal view, although probably you only recognize some of the principles as liberal because we associate liberal with, you know, some kind of, dare I say, faux social justice. But these are liberal principles. He shares things with these other guys. And one of them is about the role of government. And the thing that we first hear from these liberals and then with Hayek, like a libertarian, is that... government should be reduced as far as possible. Government is a necessary evil. Like in the best case, we wouldn't have it because we're understanding freedom in a negative way here, where freedom means absence of constraint. And we recognize that, okay, other people constitute constraints on my action, but like I should have a private sphere where nobody messes with me. Government ought to be backed off, right? And so the laissez-faire, let them do as they will model towards economic activity says back off the government entirely. But it's also important to recognize in all three of these thinkers that they don't really want the government to be backed off entirely. They want it to play a particular role. And the role that it is supposed to play is the maintenance of all those things that are necessary for the game, this profit-making competitive capitalism, which is not really competitive, this profit-making capitalist system to continue, which is first of all and primarily the maintenance of property rights and then the enforcement of contracts. But probably if we were to really step back, we would have to see that the government is necessary in order to privatize lands, to take over lands from indigenous people. Like you need a military, like at least an initial military wave to clear the ground for this game to take place. You got to get rid of all the old forms. You can't have self-sufficient population in general, because then where are you going to get a labor supply? These are the things that are never talked about in Friedman, but which in fact are like what is most obvious if you look at the implementation of the free market recommendations that he makes in Chile or in Iraq. And again, check out Naomi Klein for like very gruesome depictions of those realities. So the government is supposed to be there, and it's all about the game, right? Set up the rules of the game, interpret the rules of the game, and enforce the rules of the game. Now, that's nice language because it's an umpire we're talking about, but we are talking about state repression here, right? Enforcing the rules of the game means that, like, if we're protecting property rights, then nobody's allowed to just take property. They got to go to jail, even if they're poor. And, of course, you know, if they're poor, well, first of all, they don't fit in this picture, because every individual and every household is a producer and trader of goods who is perfectly free to exchange with anybody else if they want to, whenever they want to, according to Friedman. So the fact, first of all, that there exists empirical inequality, which is historically generated, is hidden here. But also the fact that capital itself implies and rests upon and cannot exist without fundamental inequalities and therefore unfree exchanges, that is hidden as well. So let me get into what I think Friedman is assuming and what he is hiding and where the contradictions are. And then we'll just end up with his wish list, which is very clearly the wish list of the corporate North. He assumes, just like Adam Smith does, that humans are fundamentally individualistic, that those individuals are fundamentally self-interested, that because we are fundamentally individualistic, or at best organized into households, that's our natural unit, which of course, if you look through the history of the world, is not true at all. Humans have always lived in communities, in packs or tribes or villages. That is how humans have always lived, but and with extended families, and have worked together in large groups. But we have a codification here, which is, you know, coming out of capitalist Europe, which says that humans are fundamentally individualistic. And that means that it's true that empirically in the world, we do have interactions with other people, but those other people are not an essential part of us, and they do not compose an essential part of our interest. Rather, the only connections that we have between ourselves is a relationship of exchange. We only exchange things, and we do so in order to get what we need. We're willing to give some of the stuff that we allegedly produce, including our labor, really. So we are all individuals. We are fundamentally atomized. Our households are like little businesses. We engage in relationships of exchange with other people, and that is the totality of like what is social. Now, this is going to be the doctrine, this neoliberalism, which is expressed most clearly here in Milton Friedman. This is going to be the doctrine of the 1970s, and especially the 1980s, specifically beginning with or becoming most prominent with Reagan and Thatcher. And I think about that because Thatcher will say, there is no such thing as society. There's only individuals. No such thing as society. It's an overblown word, this idea that we have some kind of community or that we are naturally social. No. And further, there is an assumption here, which is coming straight from Adam Smith, which is that we want to, like, he claims that there would be a possibility for each household to make itself self-sufficient. Now, this is objectively not the case, because proletarianization has been violently carried out through the enclosures process in Europe and through colonization in the United States and through, repeated waves of this sort of stuff. Like, for example, the industrialization of the labor force in the wake of the Civil War in the United States took people up off of their land where they really could provide for themselves, they could feed themselves, and it pulled them into factories. It took that land. It made them incapable of feeding themselves, and that's why and how and the only reason that they become wage laborers. So there's all kinds of pretension here. That the pretense is that we could produce for ourselves, we could just take care of ourselves, but we don't want to do that because we can get more stuff and we can increase general productivity if we all become specialists and trade with one another. That's straight out of Adam Smith too, right? And it's equally false. Okay, and there's all kinds of things being hidden here. The primary thing that I see being hidden is that the claim is that in competitive capitalism, all of these operators who are called individuals and households, but really you have individuals on the one hand, the majority who are laborers and have to work for a wage, and then you have these businesses on the other hand who are a small minority and profit off of that wage. So there's an utter falsification. There's a claim that supposedly individuals, households, and businesses are all kind of the same thing. They're all just a household. They're all producing things and exchanging things. And they are capable of voluntary exchange. And in the properly run free market system where the government doesn't get in the way, but just like makes sure that the rules stay in place, all exchanges will be voluntary because you could always go exchange with somebody else. If you don't like, you know, the price that somebody's offering, just go sell to somebody else. If you don't like et cetera. This is not the case at all. In plenty of cases, right? Like, you know, we don't just have the option to, like, buy housing wherever we want. We have to buy housing according to the market rate, right? Like, that's not a voluntary exchange. If I don't get housing, my kid is going to, like, you know, have to live out under a bridge and, like, is going to get sick and beat up and stuff, and I don't want that, right? This is not a voluntary situation. Somebody owns the building where I want to stay, and I have to give them what they demand or else I'll be roofless. Right? And this is true about all kinds of goods too, right? The richer we get, the more we can choose between different commodities. But generally speaking, we don't have that many options. There's 3-4 stores and they all sell the same stuff from the same brands. That's not true. But the key place where voluntary exchange is said by Friedman to take place, where it doesn't take place, and something that he doesn't talk about at all, but it, like I see just glaring through the entire text, is in the exchange between labor and management, labor and ownership, labor and capital. Now, definitely he wants us to believe that that's a free exchange as well, which is what Adam Smith said too, and Marx showed that it was false. The suggestion is that, like, okay, if I'm this individual, the thing that I really have to exchange, if you're most of us, is my time and energy. I have my labor power in Marx's terms, and I will exchange that for money because I can use that money to get the necessities of life for me and my family. Now, the codification is that's a fair deal. And all Americans, you know, are urged by their government and by their media and by their schools to believe that this is really the case. You know, there might be some employers that are going to rip you off, but generally speaking, there's a fair wage and we get paid those fair wages, right? But if you actually look at it, this is not a voluntary exchange, first of all, because I can't get anything I need. I cannot live, nor can my son, unless I get a job. And I got to get the job that is available, just like I got to pay for the house that is available and in my range, right? I don't have the option of not selling my labor. I got to sell it to somebody. Now, maybe there's a few options, but they're all going to offer me like very low wages, and I got to take what they're giving me. It's not a voluntary exchange. It's not an equal exchange. There does not exist on the side of the owner the same kind of need that exists on the side of labor. And in fact, if labor were not systematically deprived, nobody would work for a wage, and definitely not for the wages that we get. Now, if we go even further and we recognize that the profit that is produced by these conglomerates, by these companies, is actually derived from the people who work for them, but goes into the pocket of the owners and not into those people who are given just about enough to survive, then we have to recognize that none of this exchange is voluntary. The system of the even playing field and the game of competitive capitalism is not a game. It's real. We're going to die if we don't play it right. We're going to die sometimes even when we do. And it has nothing to do with evenness or equality of exchange. All this stuff is hidden, right? And then there are claims kind of like Adam Smith that we have all agreed on these structures. There exists an underlying social consensus, he'll say. Oh, yeah? Well, did you agree that you're only going to be able to live if you work, you know, 60 hours a week? Like, when were you consulted about whether capitalism was going to be the system in which you lived? No such consensus has ever happened. And then I would conclude or get about close to conclusion by saying there are lots of contradictions here, right? And the most glaring one is that competitive capitalism is the free market economy, is the system most compatible with individual and political freedom. But then it was Milton Friedman's theory itself and his students themselves in person who worked together with General Pinochet to carry out a brutal dictatorship with the backing of the U.S. military. And the same thing, these principles are exactly the principles that are applied as the United States takes over Iraq in the early 2000s. That was a profoundly violent process. You know, you clear the slate, you destroy everything in order to allow capitalism to happen. But when capitalism happens in Iraq, that just means opening up all resources in Iraq to the same old colonial powers and the primary business interests which lie at their center. So this stuff makes me crazy. To conclude, you can take a look at the last two pages of the text or the last portion of my notes. And you're just going to get a list of what it is that Friedman is recommending. And these are indeed the things that were implemented and that are implemented all over the world and that is happening to us right now and that is happening to our education. Defunding public things, that's neoliberalism. Deregulating everything, that's neoliberalism. Privatizing everything, that's neoliberalism. And then like a strong law and order police and military force, you know, a kind of neo-colonial military force, the job of which is to keep all those resources available and privatized for the global north internationally. And then a harsh police force, the job of which is to maintain property relations stateside, and a growing for-profit prison complex. These are all part of neoliberalism. So what is it that Milton is arguing against on behalf of his friends, the capitalists? Get rid of subsidies to agriculture. And in fact, actually, the capitalists like those things, so they keep them. Get rid of tariffs. Like, that's very neoliberal, which is an interesting reason that the Trump moment is like as a shift from this neoliberal policy. I don't think towards anything happier. I think towards a different form of violence, which still rests very heavily, even more heavily, upon these state forces. Any kind of controls over what has to be produced or what can't be produced, like the kind of controls that require, for example, the production of the right amount of ventilators, can't have those things. Rent controls, no, we don't want any of them. Price controls, no, can't have any of them. Minimum wage, absolutely not. Artificial control on the free market gets in the way of freedom of the businesses. No controls on the interest that lenders can demand and reply in return for lending. No regulation of industries whatsoever. So concerns about, you know, like, oh, you're going to pollute the land. Like, the way that Friedman thinks about that stuff is like, okay, you know, you can pollute the land. We'll just, like, pay the people whose land got polluted. It's no problem. There's no intrinsic value in the land in any way. This system is completely abstracted from the physical world and from the real life of real working people and people who are rooted in real places, not to mention the populations from whom this land is really taken in the first place. Let's not have any Social Security. That screws up the whole game. We can't have Social Security. Let's not have any retirement programs at all, except the ones that people voluntarily buy. So they're for profit. No licensing requirements. No public housing. No Section 8. Can't help poor people. Unemployment is natural, you know? Like, the market will regulate all that stuff. If people hurt more, maybe they'll work harder. We're not going to have any drafts. Should just be volunteer soldiers. We shouldn't have any national parks. They should be privatized. The post office ought to be privatized. Roads, freeways ought to be privatized. Now, this is all the wish list, right? And these are the things that are indeed happening in our world. And Friedman's logic, if you can call it that, is indeed the logic that justifies it. And this is where we live.